Tonight is Sunday, August 22nd, 2004. The Sunday night speakers meeting of Narcotics Anonymous welcomes our first speaker, Vivian.
My name is Vivian, I'm an addict. I want to thank Jeff for asking me to come down here and speak. And to all the people listening, hello, even though I can't see you. Basically, what I can tell you is just how it was, what happened, and where I'm at today. I'm from East LA, grew up in East LA, was born in East LA. Went to grammar school in East LA and went to East LA College before Monterey Park took it over. My mother is a recovering addict. My father has like 20-some years in sobriety. I have an older brother who's bipolar. And my younger brother still uses. And what I can tell you is that growing up in my household wasn't easy. Not for me, I'm the only girl. So you know what transpired was a lot of domestic violence, and my mother and father used to party. And it affected me in a way that I was afraid as a child growing up. And what I mean afraid is that there was a lot of fighting, a lot of verbal abuse, a lot of physical abuse. There was a lot of chaos, man. You know, my dad is a provider and he's a worker. And my mother also worked. The thing that though that caused us a lot of problems was their drinking and using. And so everyone thought that our household was together and that my mom and dad had a good marriage. And on the outside, everything seemed okay to a lot of people, not knowing of what took place inside in the family. And then growing up, my parents didn't want us to say anything about what was going on, like at the school or with our relatives. And so it was hard growing up dealing with a lot of feelings and emotions, man. And bottom line, I was told to just like fold it in. And what happened at about 12 or 13, I started smoking some pot. And the first time I smoked pot, it was a trip. It was a trip. My younger brother and I smoked it. And what happened is that my parents were coming into the pad. I didn't know that the scent of weed traveled. So when they came inside, my dad wasn't happy. My dad proceeded to take off his belt and hit my brother. And my brother and I were so loaded that we started cracking up, man. And you know, he proceeded to hit him again, but we were still laughing because we were buzzed, you know, we thought it was funny. Anyway, they asked us not to do it again, but of course we continued and are getting loaded. And for me, it was hard growing up because I was a tomboy. I didn't like basketball. You know, I liked Tonka trucks, I liked playing sports. I was the only female quarterback, I was the only female basketball player, there wasn't any co-ed sports you could really say, especially in East LA. And so I was made fun of a lot. And I was, a lot of times I was beat up, I was hit. Going to Catholic school, there weren't too many people going to Catholic school in my area, so like we were the target and they were going to chase us, and they did. My older brother, because he was highly intelligent, didn't know how to fight, so like I felt it was my job to take care of him. My younger brother was a good little guy, man, you know, and I didn't like when they picked on him either. So I took on a caretaker role at a young age, my mom being knotted out on the couch or coming home from school and putting cigarette in between her fingers, or things burnt, or the food was burnt on the outside but not cooked on the inside. That played a lot of role of how it affected me. So what I did to get out of the house was that I ran away. I became involved in gangs, and I did that not because I wanted to. I really wanted to be like them preppy kids, and I really wanted to dress nice, and I wanted to be in the giddy club. And what I did was that I played basketball as a freshman on the varsity team. But being a freshman with my peer and having everybody else older, they would pick on me too. So it was really hard, man. I didn't like to fight. I didn't want to fight. I didn't want to cause harm, but I had to learn how to fight at an early age. And I didn't like to fight because I knew it was going to hurt you, man. Because how I fought was that I would think about it, the molestation, the physical abuse, being verbally abused by the nuns, them comparing to my brother. And that's how I would release my anger. Now, so I didn't go into anger, I would go into rage. And for being a young girl, not having any sisters to talk to, not having any aunts to talk to, I associated in this gang activity because I felt a part of it. And I wore my brother's clothes and I wore my dad's clothes because, like I said, my mom and dad got loaded. They had to pay for the tuition, they had to pay for the uniform. And so it was okay to wear that clothing and be accepted. But I didn't like it. I didn't like it. And what happened is that they talk about the disease continues to progress. My disease progressed, man. I liked PCT for a long time until I got clean. And everything you could think of, I did. And what happened is that I went into college. I graduated from high school and went to college. And it was hard to fit into college. You know, I'm from East LA, and I'm a homegirl, I'm a chola, and I'm wearing my sweatshirts, and they're creased, and I'm wearing my black and white panties, and I'm wearing my tube socks, and my Levi cut shorts, and they're wearing those, back then, was like the little dolphin shorts, and like, you know, I was not a part of the little basketball team. I didn't dress like them, I didn't speak like them. But needless to say, some of them got loaded like the way I got loaded. And that common bond of being an addict, man, wherever you're at, it's there. And so our team was a little diverse group. We had an Asian, we had black, we had white, a couple of us Mexican. So getting loaded, it was all right. What's hard about being in school was that, like I'm telling you, I dressed differently. I wore Pendletons, I wore sweatshirts, I wore khakis. And there weren't very few people that dressed like me when I was going to college. So I had the sociology teacher and the psychology teacher and the math teacher, and I don't blame them from them the way they looked at me, but I knew that I didn't want to work in a warehouse, and I don't want to work in a factory, and I don't want to have kids and be on welfare. And my father always encouraged me to do something better with my life and to get some education. So I played basketball for 2 years, and I can tell you that I didn't play well because a lot of times I was under the influence and my basketball court was that side, but I'd be running down the other side because I was loaded. So anyways, I graduated from college with a liberal arts degree, and I was too ashamed or embarrassed to go to university or to ask for help. My brother went to Harvard. He was about 16, 17. And what happened is that when your bipolar disease subdues when you're a teenager and it comes back out when you're a young adult. And his behavior was inappropriate and unacceptable, so they sent him back home. And it was really devastating for me to know that my brother had a nervous breakdown, because my brother was my role model, because in our environment and the people that we grew up with, he was going to make it and do something with his life. And so that really impacted me, and what I did is that I left to San Francisco, and I worked for the Conservation Corps. And in doing that, all I did was party, man. I partied because East LA was the problem, my family was the problem, my environment was the problem. Not knowing that wherever I went, drugs was always going to be there. What happened was that somebody found it necessary to let my staff know that I was selling drugs on a naval base. And the option was to either go to the brig or resign. So they terminated me because I didn't meet their standards after being there for almost 2 years. When I came back, I wanted to commit suicide. I was familiar with guns, we had guns, and I wanted to shoot myself. Here I am with a college education, and look where I'm back at my grandmother's house, sleeping in the front room on a small bed or on the couch. And what am I doing with my life? The only reason why I didn't shoot myself was because I'm a kind of person that, with my luck, I would shoot myself and I'd end up being a vegetable. So needless to say, I didn't do that. What happened is that I became a school bus driver, started driving. The disease progresses. My disease started with, it progressed to coke and heroin. I said I would never do heroin or coke. And I started getting loaded on the weekends. They were testing back then, but I would clean my system. I started getting loaded during the week. I started getting loaded during work. Started hitting the bumps on the freeways with the kids. And they yelled at me to bust over, get up, wake up, because I did not enough. During that period of time, I went to my mom for help, and she took me to my first meeting. When I went to my first meeting, it was about 15 years ago. And I'm going to tell you, man, I did not feel like I belonged there. These people did not have any teeth. They were talking about being retired and that they were on vacation, and this guy had this, I don't know, a tank or something, and I'm looking at these people, and I'm like, I don't belong here, man, you know, I'm too young. At that time, I was 27. The next 30 days, I went to meetings. I get clean, I get loaded, I get clean, I get loaded. And what I distinctively remember was that they said, go to 90 meetings in 90 days, and if you don't like this, we will gladly refund your misery. And my head thought, fuck you. You know, and I evaluated my life, and I came to see where I was at, and I was doing a lot of coke, so I always thought the SWAT team was after me, and that the narcs were following me, and that I had these little magnets in the speakers of the car. I was just paranoid, man. I thought everybody was after me, even in the daytime. So I said, well, I'm going to go to these 90 meetings in 90 days, and I'm going to check out what this thing is about. And what I did is that what attracted me to Narcotics Anonymous, it wasn't how you were dressed. It wasn't what you had. It was your feelings. It was your emotions. It was how you were dealing with life. How you were dealing with death and finances and low self-esteem. And I didn't think anything was funny when I got here, man. Everybody was laughing. I didn't want to laugh because I wasn't happy. You know, I was coming down. And then you wanted to hug me and hold my hand. I didn't even know you people. And then you say, let us love you till you can love yourself. And I'm thinking, you know, like all that corny stuff, like, it just didn't make sense. And all these, keep it simple, turn it over, surrender, one day at a time, like, what the hell are these people talking about? And they're talking about a sponsor and traditions, and, but I don't want to get loaded anymore. I wanted to stay clean. So I got a sponsor, and I started working the steps, and it was very hard for me to raise up my hand and to say that I was an addict. For the first 6 months of my recovery, I wouldn't raise my hand because I had too much pride and ego, and I don't want to be like you. Don't you understand? I don't prostitute. Don't you understand? I never went to the joint. Don't you know? I don't slam. You know, I'm not like you people. I came in with a car. But what I found out is that I had to stop looking at the differences and look at the similarities. And the similarities for me was that people wanted to make a change. I had done a lot of harm to myself, plus other people, especially my family. And then admitting that I was powerless, my life had become manageable, was that if I could control drugs, I wouldn't be in Narcotics Anonymous. If I was okay, I wouldn't be in a roach-infested house with 14 people. I wouldn't come from having a nice chest as a refrigerator, or candles for light, or plugging the extension cord from the neighbor across the street and the police running it over and saying that we had to unplug it. You know, or having a blanket for windows. And I had to look at all that, but it's only because listening to people pointing this out to me why I was an addict and what I could go back to. And so I admitted that I was powerless, my life had become manageable, and that drugs control me, I can't control drugs. And came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity was that, because coming from a line of mental illness and families, man, I really thought that I belonged in Metropolitan State Hospital. But it was listening to you people and the things that you did, like jumping out of cars that were moving, or doing whatever it was that you do, that I knew that I wasn't all that messed up. That I knew that you people were like me, but that you were voicing about how you felt, and you didn't have to get loaded behind it. And making a decision was that I didn't want to do that third step. I didn't want to do that third step because I thought that if I did it and I didn't do it right, that something was wrong for me because I come from a Catholic background. I was a Sunday school teacher. I knew about the Bible. I went to college school. And if I don't do this third step, man, and do it totally right because I had some reservations of my own behavior, what's going to happen to me? And my sponsor said, you know what, Vivian, you just do it one day at a time and do this third step. So I go on to do this inventory, right? I have a year clean, starting to really feel, I knew that that first year was about, I just need to stay clean, I need to go to meetings, I need to go to morning meetings, I need to go to women's tag, I got to go to speaker meetings, I got to get a commitment, I got to get connected. And I did, man, in that first 2 weeks that I was clean, I got a book study commitment, I stood with that commitment for 2 years. And within that first 30 days too, I got involved in H&I because somewhere along the line I heard that 79% of people that get involved in H&I stay clean. And so that's what I did for 14 years until after when I gave it up. What H&I did for me, what it truly did was that it saw that my problems were nothing compared to people that were in juvenile hall, that were in Twin Towers, that were in prison, that were in mental institutions, mom, because all it told me is that if I ever get loaded again, this is where I could end up, because I have yes, that I'm eligible too. And I really believe in Narcotics Anonymous because I'm doing this inventory. You know, I used to be tensed up in the meetings. I used to rock back and forth in my chair. I used to sit on my hands. My leg used to move by itself. You know, I'd be tripping out. I felt like there was something heavy on my shoulders. And when I did this inventory, I was alright doing the inventory. What got my, what was fearful for me was to share it with somebody. What is this lady going to think about me? Is this lady going to go talk about me in meetings? Because I have a lot of trust issues, man. My homeboys and homegirls, for whatever what they did, my parents didn't take care of me. They didn't protect me. They either hid me and knew about molestation and did nothing about it. The police were always on my back. So I got this trust issue with someone that I've just gotten to know, and I'm going to tell her about myself. So she says, Vivian, she says, Vivian, have you ever fucked a watermelon? I said, no, I never fucked a watermelon. She said, well, you know what my sponsor did and my sponsor wrote about it. So go ahead and tell me what's going on with you, because whatever you've done has been done before you, and whatever you've done is going to be done after you. She said, and if I haven't done it, I probably thought about it. So for me, you know, I'm an addict that from where I come from and the discipline that was put into my life from my grandparents and my parents is that I'm not the kind that you have to use a kid gloves. You got to tell me straight up. You got to tell me what's up. They didn't do this. This is a life and death program. And I don't hear a lot about that anymore. I don't hear about shutting up in the meeting. You know, a lot of these people want to socialize and make jokes, and that's fine. You're the kind of person that wants to make jokes and disrupt the meetings. I'm the kind of person that tells you to be quiet because I want to hear. Because I didn't come here through a parole agent, and I didn't come in here through a recovery home, and I didn't come in here through a detox, and I didn't come because of probation. I didn't come because of all that. I came because I was sick and tired, and I don't want to play around, and I want to get my act together. So I don't need all your little games and all of that crap. You can do it outside. And so in doing this inventory and sharing about who I was, you know, that I had to deal with my sexuality. I grew up in East LA. I don't know anybody that's really gay. If you're gay, people chase you. They talk about you. They make fun of you. My family is Catholic or Christian. I have an aunt who's a nun. You know, and what happened was that I needed to share about me. Because if I didn't share about me, I was going to kill myself because I could not deal with the fact that I was gay. I could not accept it. I didn't know that it was okay. But in the readings where it talks about regardless of age, race, sexual identity, religion, or lack of religion, I kind of had hope with that and I wanted to believe it. But I go to these meetings and I hear people talk and make little jokes. And my brother, when he was going to the meetings with them, he goes, David, you want me to do something? I go, David, leave him alone. You know, they got the right to express how they feel. They don't know what's going on. I mean, if they do, that's cool. But I'm not going to go around hitting everybody in their name because they're homophobic. You know, and what I saw was that just like with HIV, you know, I have a lot of friends who have HIV. I have friends who died of AIDS. I have friends that have hepatitis. And I remember back then, you couldn't talk about that. They didn't want you to talk about it in meetings. And I'm thinking, well, where the hell am I supposed to go? And I didn't want to drive to Long Beach, and I was tired of driving to Whittier, and I wasn't going to drive to Hollywood. I'm gay. I'm from East LA. This is who I am. Because I didn't feel that I had a goal to people please anymore, man. I earned my seat in this room. And so I started sharing about it, and I had to share about it with my family. My mom, I knew she was going to have a hard time, and she did have a hard time. My dad just told me, you know what, Mija? I've loved you all the time, and I'm always going to love you. Because I knew when you used to catch that football sunway, I knew you were different. You know, because my dad used to take me fishing, and we used to do all these sports, and he would say, oh, I would tell you to do this and that. So he goes, I knew you were a little bit better than your brother, but I didn't want to tell you, but it's okay. So I learned that when I started accepting me for me, other people started accepting me for me. People who had children or their brothers or sisters would talk to me. And I felt very privileged to meet a lot of people that were ashamed to talk about having HIV because you might think that they were gay when they were straight. You know, and that stuff affected a lot of people. And some people I knew were not behind it. But thank God there's a lot of people that are open, that really believe in one addict helping an addict no matter what. So So dealing with these character defects is that I didn't want to have character defects. I thought my perception is that if I have character defects, I'm a bad person, that I'm no good, that something is wrong with me. To tell you that I had lust or ego or pride or greed or envy or anger. You know, how do you tell people that this is who you are and they're going to say you're okay? What I learned is that I'm always going to have these character defects, but that they get better. And that I don't have to act on them as I did before. And that it's a part of who I am. This is my personality, man. And if I'm going to make changes, I'm going to make those changes. And if I'm not, I'm not. But I'm the one who's going to pay the price, regardless. Because I'm going into this eighth and ninth step. What happened is that making amends, I could never get the concept of making correct amends except when to do so would injure them or others, because I felt a lot of people didn't deserve amends. And my sponsor said, Vivian, you're not doing it for the people, you're doing it for you. You're doing it to get rid of that resentment and that anger. And so I did that. And I'm not telling you just when I had that first and second year. I've always continued to work the steps. I love my sponsor. My sponsor, she's cool, man. My sponsor lives in Palos Verdes. She's white. She's nothing, has no, nothing Mexican oriented. But she's cool people, man, and she's a teacher, and she has taught me a lot, and her husband is cool, they're real cool, and what I like about them, the way they dress is nothing compared to how they live. They don't try to impress, they don't show their money, they have a tough cat, I love that house, it's a Barbie doll, it's pink, I love it, man. But they love me, they accept me, they talk to me, they don't talk down to me. And that's one thing I like about Narcotics Anonymous, is that I have met a lot of people from all different cultures, from all different areas, and a lot of people are cool, man. They're just fucking cool. And so, going to the 10th step, you know, continuing to take personal inventory, is that I have to check myself. And a lot of times I don't want to check myself. And a lot of times I don't want to change. Because I'm going to tell you, I like drama. And I like chaos. And I like insanity, and I'm going to tell you why. When I do what I'm supposed to do, I get up in the morning and I pray, and I go to work, then I go to a meeting, then I talk with my sponsors, then I visit my mom and dad, then I go home. And I do the same thing repetitious. Sometimes I want to get in the mix. Sometimes I want to throw it for myself, and I put that wrench into the dryer. And I'm sure none of you do that, and I'm sure that you all just Mr. NA and NA. But this is about being honest, man. And I've done a lot of stuff that I wasn't supposed to do. I know about taking money from the seventh. I know about being with newcomers. I know about character assassinating. I know about not being responsible and not showing up to my commitment and not talking to anybody and asking them to do it. Anything that they say not to do, I've done that. Because I got to be honest with me in order to be honest with you, because you know if I'm lying. You can't lie to a bullshit or not. You could read me. You know if I'm for real or not. And one thing I learned about Narcotics Anonymous, I would rather tell myself than have you tell, because you're going to get the story wrong anyway. So, you know, after prayer meditation is that I was in a wheelchair for 3 years. And in my 7th year of recovery, my ex-girlfriend and I broke up. And I was in a bad bus accident. And in those 3 years that I lived in a wheelchair, they said I would never walk. But deep down inside, his voice used to tell me, you're going to be okay, you're going to be okay. And I know I thought it was God. And what happened is that the arthritis ate up the cartilage in my hips. And it took them a little while to detect it. But after 97 and 98, I had my left hip replacement and my right hip replacement. And it's only because of the power of God and the power of prayer, the people in the rooms, that I'm able to walk today. About 3 years ago, I had my neck cut up. And what happened with that is that the intubation from the surgery in my hips caused a 75% air blockage, and they had to remove 5 of my inner rings. And it was the people in Narcotics Anonymous that went to go see me. My sponsor went to go see me. My dad went faithfully. And my dad is really grateful to Narcotics Anonymous, to the people that emotionally supported me, that went to come and see me at that hospital. And you know, a lot of people put down the general hospital, but it was a general hospital that diagnosed me properly, that kept me alive. The other thing I need to tell you is that I died in ICU. And it was only because of the grace of God that I'm able to be here to tell you about Narcotics Anonymous. The 12th step in working with others is that if I didn't believe in Narcotics Anonymous, I wouldn't be here. I would not drive from East LA to Santa Monica I just started my master's program. I have a 10-page paper due. We're being audited at my agency. But I thought, you know what, Vivian? You know what? It's only because of Narcotics Anonymous that you're here. It's only because of Narcotics Anonymous that you get to go to school. It's only because of Narcotics Anonymous that you get to drive and get up and get to have a job. It's only because of Narcotics Anonymous. And for me, to give back is to go to Antelope Valley or Long Beach or San Pedro or Riverside and do this thing that they talk about. Because a lot of my friends have gotten loaded. A lot of my friends, they relapsed, man. And I got clean with some good people. I just had a friend that I was close with get loaded a couple of weeks ago, man, and it messed me up. And the disease is powerful, man. This disease will take you out. But I know that in order to stay here, I need to go to meetings. I need to sponsor. I need to work the steps. And I need to be of service. And if anything, what I could tell you is that, you know, that whatever you're going through, I don't know what you're going through. I don't know why you're here, but I always heard this in meetings. That whatever you're going through, it's only temporary. And that it's going to pass. And that, you know what, that there is a higher power. And that higher power for me is God. And that God has done for me so many things that I could never, ever think, never think that would happen in my life. And because of Narcotics Anonymous, I love my dad and my mom. I take my mom to her morning Saturday meeting, and sometimes I go to church with my dad. My other two brothers, I love them. I don't want to shoot them. I don't want to stab them. You know, and I'm going to tell you this before I end. I'm not perfect. I'll never be perfect. And I do a lot of stuff. But I know that one day at a time, it does get better. I'm very grateful to Narcotics Anonymous, and thank you for letting me share. Thank you.